Get ready for family fun that's out of this world at Big Air Trampoline Park inside Fieldhouse USA at the Polaris Mall. With over 40 attractions included in the admission price, there's something for everyone. From birthday parties to toddler time, and even daily deals like Mega Jump Mondays and Wednesdays, 2-for-1 Tuesdays, and family fun packages on Thursdays and Sundays, Big Air Columbus does it all. Big Air Columbus, where the fun never ends. Visit bigairusa.com/Columbus for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, July 17th, the Ethan Hawke in a Minivan edition. I'm Allison Benedict, an editor at Slate and the mom of Harry 5, Sam 3, and Wally 1.
And I'm Dan Coyce. I'm the new editor-in-chief of Slate. And I'm the dad of Lyra, who is 9, and Harper, who is 6. I'm not really, but Julia Turner is. It's very exciting.
If you're
a listener and not a reader, go check it out. We have a brand new editor-in-chief. She's great.
On today's show, we'll talk to writer-director Richard Linklater about his new movie, Boyhood, and then to writer, not director, Rebecca Onion about her attempt to craft a pre-pregnancy contract with her husband. Also, parenting triumphs and fails, recommendations, and a Slate reader email, not a call, but an email, on how political to get when talking to young kids about gay parents. But before we get to all that, I'm going to get all of our reminders and nags out quickly because I'm sick of this taking a long time. 1, subscribe to Mom and Dad Are Fighting on iTunes or your favorite podcast app and keep spreading the word. 2, sign up for Slate Plus or at least try it out for free for 2 weeks. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. Okay, that's it.
Good job.
Dan, on to triumphs and fails. What do you got?
All right. I've got a fail this week. So it's not a huge fail, but it was just sort of a frustration that we had, which is that we went to Wisconsin over July 4th weekend to visit my family. And, you know, sometimes you have these trips, and at the end of them, you're like, man, that was a great trip. That everything was great. We had fun. Some things went wrong, but whatever, it was great. But that was not how we felt at the end of this trip. In general, it was just a frustrating trip. We're busy, and so we did not plan it well. I didn't, like, reach out to a lot of people ahead of time to make plans. I didn't, like, talk to my parents about what we were going to do. And I think I sort of had it in the back of my head, my mom and dad, they'll plan some stuff for all of us to do. But they didn't plan anything for us to do. But that is not their fault.
Your parents failed.
It's my fault for not saying, hey, it would really help us for you to plan some stuff for us to do or whatever. Like, so the trip was just, like, a lot of it was like my kids sitting around my mom's tiny house complaining that there was nothing to do. And, you know, they played with some friends and they rode bikes a little bit and we went to a Brewers game. But every day was like a little bit of an ordeal to get out the house and find some damn thing for us to do. And what's open and where should we go? And are the kids just going to bitch if we take them to this place? And like we never even got out of the house before like noon any day. So it wasn't like a terrible trip, but it was not that fun for them. And so we left the kids in Wisconsin for a couple of days. Ollie and I flew home. We left the kids with their grandparents.
Because it was so bad, or you were planning to do
it? Because it was so bad that we were like, fuck everything. No, it was just, that was the plan. Like, the plan was for them. Lyra did a thing in Madison with my dad. This thing that is going to be my recommendation, in fact, this week. And so they had some plans. And so, but in general, I feel like, I think they had more fun when we were out of the way. Like when we were not there being like, oh, what, like, mom, why didn't you think of something to do? And when it was just them with my parents, I think they had a fine time. And I mean, the good news is that I did try to make up my fail from last episode about being rude to my mom by refinancing her mortgage. So I think that helped. That helped in the long run. But the trip, other than that, was sort of a bummer.
I kind of see that as a triumph because now you have constructed it in such a way that your parents are like, you know what? It's better if you just leave the kids with us and you guys
well,
go
that's,
your own
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that's the overall like a big triumph win. For yeah. sure. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well, I had a triumph. It was also about our 4th of July week. Sorry, ours was good. But
America.
We go every year to my husband's father's family cottage, a sort of cluster of cottages owned by various cousins on the water. I'm making it sound like some fancy estate. It's actually not. Each cottage has one bathroom, and you're only allowed to flush when you go number two. But
only one bathroom? Oh.
No, why only have one bathroom? I'm sorry. Each cottage only has one bathroom and houses many families at once.
Okay.
And you're only allowed to flush when you go number two. That is just my way of saying it's not this luxurious estate by the water.
Right.
Anyway, we go over summer. It's wonderful. There's history there. The kids see their cousins. They stay up until, you know, 11 o'clock at night every night playing flashlight tag or whatever tag they play, zap. And it's a blast. But there's also some, and it's really also wonderful every year to see their progression and the things that they can do with the other kids that are there. And last summer, there was a huge psychodrama for Harry because all the kids, all his cousins were pressuring him to jump off the pier into the water, and he was too scared. And every day, it was like the same thing every day that they would like pump him up at breakfast, and he'd say he was going to do it, and we'd all go out there, and he'd get his little toes on the edge of the water, I mean, the edge of the pier. And then he'd be too scared.
Oh, my God.
And I...
So Harry is like... Harry is little me, FYI.
That and little me, too. And yeah, feeling so horrible for him getting all this peer pressure, this cousin pressure, I was constantly, all week, this was last year, constantly always saying, like, it's okay, Harry, you don't have to do it. There's no, you know, no pressure. You don't... Whatever. I was trying to make it easier for him. This year, we got there, first of all, A, he jumped right off, which was great. Triumph for Harry.
Awesome.
Good job, Harry. But then the new pressure came with everyone telling him that he did it with a life jacket. And the rule is that you have to do it with a life jacket until you pass the swimming test. I'm sorry, the story is getting really long. So his cousins started pressuring him again that he could pass the swimming test and take off his life jacket. And he wanted to take the swimming test. And I knew that he would fail. I knew he couldn't pass the swimming test. He doesn't really know how to swim. He's learning, but he doesn't. But instead of saying, trying to protect him from that failure, I triumphed and I let him fail. We got in the water with him, or my husband, John, got in the water with him. He tried to take the swimming test, which is jumping off the pier with no life jacket and swimming to the shallow end where you can stand.
Right.
He, like, was flailing around and, like, pre-drowning.
Right.
And we let him do that as much as we could. And then
right.
John grabbed him, and he was, you know, disappointed. He thought he could do it. He was angry at John for grabbing him because he thought he was actually swimming, which he wasn't. But... But then he was fine, and he wants to try it again. He wasn't, like, dissuaded. He's asked me again since we've been back if he can take the swimming test at a different pool because we're not going back to the cottage next summer. And I feel like he triumphed by, you know, failing and being cool with it and wanting to try again, and I triumphed by letting him fail.
I think that's a great triumph. That's
Thank
very
you.
Good. Yes, he will be very motivated to learn to swim, for example,
yeah.
with that in his memory.
Yes, that's what I think, too. Okay, on to our first topic. Richard Linklater made his great new film, Boyhood, over the course of 12 years, filming his actors as they aged. It's the story of Mason, who we meet as a young boy and watch grow into a young man, but it's also the story of his mom and dad, played by Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke, who we meet as young parents and watch grow into middle age, a process that Dan and I are currently quite familiar with.
Jesus.
Sorry, I was going to do that little joke and then it wasn't working, so I just play it straight. We're both becoming middle age. We both are. We are so thrilled to have Richard Linklater, father and filmmaker, in the DC studio to talk about Boyhood, both the movie and the stage of life and its inevitable partner, parenthood. Hi, Richard.
Hey, good to be here.
So Mason has one mother figure in this movie, his biological mom, but he has many father figures. There's his biological dad, but also a series of stepdads and stand-ins who, though mostly assholes, each brings some, I thought, fairly relatable parenting style and baggage to Mason's life. And as a mom of three boys, I couldn't help but think while watching that there's something I'll never understand about fathers and sons. What is it?
Well, I think the whole world, you mentioned there's the stepfathers who are in his life, but then there's also teachers and the whole culture. I mean, I wanted to capture that feeling when you're a kid. It feels like everybody's in your face, but men in particular feel like it's their job to kind of mold you for the world. Like a mom, I think, well, you know, they're parenting, but you're more likely to be concerned with just you and your soul or something. Or men feel it's their job quite often to really influence you and shape you. And I think that's where the stepfathers come in. You kind of resent their presence and their authority on you, and they come off like assholes. But I think they're really just kind of stuck with – themselves in a situation. They're basically doing their best. But from the kid's point of view, yeah, they're totally invading their space and exerting authority that they really don't have the right to. So that's how it feels when you're a kid.
Do you think that that's unique to being a boy as a kid, that the men want to mold you in that way? Or do you think that that happens to boys and girls?
I think that happens to everybody, probably. Mm-hmm. There is that thing about being a man and all these men telling you what to do. That's how it felt to me as a kid. I wish everyone would just shut up.
Right. Well, and there's a certain sense that many men in Mason's life, it seems like, feel like they need to define manhood for him. And the movie is very interested in what manhood is as much as it is in Boyhood.
Yeah. And even the older boys, like he's in eighth grade, he ends up at a camp out with these seniors. There's two guys who happen to be seniors in high school.
So those jerks.
He gets a taste of what it is to be a, you know, a jerk of that age. But I think it's important, you know, the way they talk about women and, you know, they mess with them, bordering on violence. You know, it's important that Mason kind of absorbs that. And I think his own little triumph is that he kind of chooses not to be one of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, by the end of the movie, it's clear he's not one of those kind of guys.
But he's he's his dad.
He's probably some version of his dad. Yes.
Yeah. I love that scene. There's a scene late in the movie for listeners who have not seen it yet, and you should definitely see it. But I don't think it's like a big spoiler or anything to say that there's a scene later in the movie on one of Mason's birthdays where he gets as gifts a Bible, a suit, and a gun. And I love that as sort of a mini
man
encapsulation. Right. It's like a mini encapsulation of one idea of one generation's, or rarely actually two generations' ideas of what manhood entails. And as you were making this movie, Richard, what did you end up thinking about what kind of man Mason would become and how in the end all these different things affected him?
Well, that's fairly autobiographical. When I was 13, it was for Christmas, not a birthday. My step-grandmother and father, you know, sweetest people ever, but she gave me a Bible with my name on it and, you know, all Jesus's words in red, you know, a personal Bible. And then my stepfather gave me a shotgun, you know, and so, which was wonderful, you know, at the time we shot a lot of targets, and, you know, but I realized I was having a very southern rural, you know, experience there. And like a lot of our country, I think that's just a cultural reality. Years later, I started thinking about that and said, you know, that's kind of funny. That's kind of interesting. Maybe it meant something. I always make a joke. That was my redneck bar mitzvah. But but yeah, years later I could use that in some way. But I don't know what it really says. You know, I don't know both those items, the gun and the Bible, they exist. I don't know to what degree they will shape Mason or influence him.
When you're watching the movie, you're watching these characters pass through time. But for me, even I think more moving was watching these actors pass through time and watching the parents get a little chubbier and get wrinkles. And, you know, Dan was saying earlier before the show that he sort of went in and out of identifying with Mason and identifying with the parents. I pretty much stuck with the parents throughout. When people watch this movie, it depends on their stage of life, what they're going to connect to. I wonder making it, I mean, you said some, you know, there's obviously autobiographical parts, but were you relating to the parents or...
Both. Yeah. I mean, the movie ends up being called Boyhood, but it could just as easily be called Parenting or Parenthood. I guess that had already been taken. But, but yeah, I always saw it as that because that's where I started from. When I started this movie, I'd been a parent for, you know, 6, 7, 8 years. And that's where I started thinking about making a film about growing up. But I also knew it'd be a reflection of parenting and kind of bumbling through parenting and figuring that out. And I think both Patricia and Ethan's characters are kind of consciously doing their best, and you see the flaws and all in both of their approaches. And I just have to say, Patricia and Ethan give these really vanity-free performances. They allow the trajectory of their characters to show all those years and to you see the toll time kind of takes on all of us psychically, physically, and all that. But, you know, I still see them as kind of in their own way kind of great people, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I really got the impression that they were parents trying the best they could, and I really like that the movie made them not just parents but characters that exist outside of their kids. You know, they have lives and they have concerns.
And they both reach their own maturity for that level. Here they are at the end of the movie in their 40s, and, you know, she got everything she was setting out to do largely in that first episode. She went back to school. She got an education. She got a post, you know— She got a master's. She got a teaching job. She, you know, and him too. He settled down and has a career and can support a family. And, you know, they both got their own piece of the American dream by working hard and, you know, living by that contract. You could see it as a compromise, but
Well, they're also both frustrated
compared
in ways,
to what?
Right?
But yeah. Who isn't?
Right.
You know,
right.
Life is, you know, a series of kind of compromises and little maneuverings you have to do to just make it all work for you and your family. And you could see that as a triumph if you can get through it, you know, and feel okay about yourself and your family, or you could feel frustrated. It's just kind of up to each individual, I guess.
And that's the contrast. Oh, sorry, Dan. No, I was just going to say that's the contrast with Mason. He's still young enough to feel like, you know, his dad getting a minivan is like the most horrible thing. Trading his awesome car for a minivan is so horrible because he doesn't, you know, he can't see in his future.
Yeah. I mean, that's a total defeat. That's and not only that he sold it and gave it away because he thought he was going to get the car, but it's a total capitulation. But actually, by the time you're in your 40s, you go, you know, that thing's an expensive maintenance, sucking, gas guzzling,
right.
Polluting,
right?
Super, you know, it's a, you know, we love that kind of muscle car from the late 60s, but it, you know, it makes no sense.
It makes as little sense as living the life of a 20-year-old when you're a dad.
Yeah. 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 So he has put away childish things.
Right.
Finally.
Do you see reflections of your own parenting style in those two parents? Is there anything about Olivia's parenting or about Mason Sr.'s parenting that reminds you of you as a parent?
Oh, gosh. I think it must to a large degree. I'm kind of self-conscious about the way Ethan will just speak up and say, hey, we're going to talk to each other. He's,
right.
He's very self-consciously putting it on the table that he's parenting and trying to do his best or trying to learn from it. I kind of do that with my kids. I'll look over and go, hey, so are you having an okay childhood? You know, what could be better? You know, how could we improve this? You know, I'll just kind of kid. I'm kidding. I'm sort of tongue in cheek. And I'll talk about my dilemma as a dad. Well, as your dad, I'm supposed to do this, but I'm not going to because, you know, whatever. I'm kind of self-reflective dad who, I always tell people, you're going to get it wrong no matter what. You might as well have kind of fun doing it.
Your daughter plays Mason's sister in the movie. Can you talk a little bit about how much she hated you through that process?
No, it was actually a very, very fun, very natural thing for us to do as a daughter and a father. And, you know, I never cast her in this movie. She cast herself, if you want to get technical. Once she realized there was a part for a older sister that was in her age range, she was just like, oh, well, I'm going to play that part. And that was who she was at that time. And I was like, yeah, well, good. I'll know where you are every year. One less volatile element to sink this movie somewhere along the way. At least I'll know where you are. And she's kind of perfect. I'm very proud of her.
She's great.
She worked hard.
Yeah.
And the utter familiarity I have with her and intimacy just allowed – I mean, I think if you could always make a movie with people you live with and know so well. I could make a movie of anybody, actor or not, because I just knew every little thing that and how to maybe use it in the movie.
It probably helped that it was just a couple days a year.
It was only three. There was only 1 year she kind of wanted to opt out. She asked me very politely and sweetly, like, Dad, can my character, like, die? You know? I was like, no, Lorelai, that would be a little dramatic for the movie we're trying to make. So, no, you can't. You will have to dress up.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to dress up and do this. And then at some point she realized she was getting paid every year. You know, SAG minimum is pretty good money for an adult.
Yeah.
And it's really good money for a 13-year-old.
Right.
Yeah.
You make more in her week of working on this movie than working at, you know, babysitting all summer. So once she realized that, she wanted to buy a harp. She was playing the harp. I was like, great, you can pay for half of it. You know, it was a fun thing in our lives. No doubt about it.
You've done well if the thing your daughter wants to blow her money on is a harp.
Yeah, for real. Not a GTO.
Hey, those things retain their value.
Yeah.
Damn, I'm happy about that.
There's a one thing that I really found interesting watching it as a dad of girls and as a one-time son was there's a lot of sports early in the movie, right? He's teaching them how to throw football. He takes them to an Astros game. But it becomes sort of clear later on in Mason Jr.'s life that he just doesn't care about sports that much.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that mirrored Ellar Coltrane or if that was a choice that you made in creating the movie, but I know that you played sports, right?
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, you played baseball. Were you sort of surprised that in this particular boy's story, sports did not end up being a defining feature the way they were for you?
No, I think – well, I made a choice early on. I was meeting a lot of kids, and Ellar, I could tell he was going to grow up and be – his parents are artists.
Mm-hmm.
he didn't have any interest in sports. Mm-hmm. Where if I would have interviewed me at 6 or 7, I was football and baseball.
Right.
That was my entire life.
Right.
So I met kids like that, smart, you know, good actor kids. And I made a choice. I was like, well, what's the better part of myself? The thoughtful, you know, kind of vaguely, you know, sensitive, mysterious kid who likes music and movies, or the little jock kid who might end up class president and all that. I went with that other side, the more, that thoughtful side. I just thought it'd be a more interesting movie. But yeah, I never thought he would grow up and I would be filming him in a sporting event. I kind of thought he would be a musician because his father's a good musician, but he ended up a visual artist. So I was happy to include, you know, photography as his, you know, passion. And that made a lot of sense. The film was always going to go where Eller went, but I didn't miss that at all. I mean, I think I wanted to show a dad who you feel obliged as a father to expose your kids to sports.
Right.
Like, oh, I'm supposed to, let's go throw the ball. But if it doesn't take, you can't really force it.
Do you think a movie called Girlhood would be a completely different movie?
Yeah. I mean, not completely. I think it could have a very similar tone. I mean, this is really girlhood. I would say the first half of this movie is largely girlhood. It could be girlhood. It only when – I think when Eller's character gains more agency and it's his point of view is more enforced and it's his world, that it becomes really more of a male movie in that regard. But she, you know, his sister Samantha is probably a more predominant character in such a large, you know, large, especially the first half of the movie, because that mirrors, I had two older sisters. I have two older sisters, and they, at that age, they sort of dominated me the way my parents did. You know, as a little one, they're really kind of screwing with you and you know, influencing you quite a bit. So I wanted to show that in the movie. But yeah, you see her, but again, kind of from his point of view, largely, she's the annoying older sister, where as they age, you know, she becomes more of a partner, I think. They're in it together. And that's how it was with my sisters.
Their relationship is really great and really interesting.
Yeah.
Did Lorelai and Eller, did they see each other outside of the shooting of the movie? Did they have a chance to build any kind of relationship like that?
Because for each of them, when we started, I mean, Lorelai didn't have a brother. Eller didn't have a sister. They immediately fell into this kind of sibling thing that was both bonding and, you know, rivalrous and really fascinating. They fell into it and they maintained it. And I think they're really bonded, because they went through something that no one else has ever gone through.
Yeah, yeah.
And here at the end, they're kind of holding each other going, God, we're exposed. Our awkward ages and everything is, my God, two people haven't ever been portrayed in this way. These fictional characters, but it's them and all their, you know, through the awkward and the beautiful. So they really do relate to one another and, you know, the way they've been through it as a family. But it was fun to see them mature. But they were always friends. We lived in the same town. Mm-hmm. Eller, we'd go to movies, and I think they have their own special relationship.
It makes me happy to think that they will, like, know each other going forward the way that fictional Mason and Samantha would know each other going forward. That's just nice to hear.
Yeah, there's a bond, and I think they both can kind of get on each other's nerves in ways too. So
good.
when they were going through their awkward phases, was it also harder for them to act? Like, were they more insecure?
I don't ever remember that, really. This was such a, I don't know, it was just a part of their lives. I never remember that being an issue. We always worked the same way. Eller said he had a couple awkward years, but I never felt that at all as working with him. And through Lorelai's more self-conscious years, I just tried to use that in the movie in some way. You know, when they're going on the camping trip and he's talking about contraception, that's kind of where she was at. And I said, oh, let's film that this year, and let's film her first. Because when he says some of those words, I know exactly what she's going to do. It's just cringe and wish
scene.
You just to hear those words are just so cringeworthy, like, you know, condoms. And she's like, oh, no. So
yeah, her face is great.
That's where she was at that very moment.
And he just gets up and walks away, or tries to walk away.
He tries to.
Yeah.
He tries to.
You mentioned kids. I know you have Lorelai, a daughter. Do you have a son now at this point?
No, I have two 10-year-old twins, so all girls.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like you.
Well, I mean, that's a fine way to go, obviously.
Yeah.
Although Allison doesn't understand it at all with her three boys, but
not at all. Yeah, my three girls. I'm so happy with them.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Good talking to you guys.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks a lot for coming in. We really appreciate it. The movie is great.
The movie.
The mysteries of parenting. It's a bottomless well.
Oh, you have any parting words of wisdom for us? Our kids are younger than yours.
hang in there. No, enjoy it. Enjoy, especially up to whatever that teenage years. I'm sure everyone's already told you. Enjoy these early years. I got the best of both worlds. I've got one who's already out of the house. And then the 10-year-olds, I'm treasuring every second because I know it ends. It changes. It just becomes something else. But I'm so enjoying this. I'm not taking it for granted this time.
Watching this movie has really inspired me to try and, like, I'm not going to make a 12-year movie with my kids, but I want to find some sort of enduring project to do with them that I feel like, I mean, that's a lesson to take as a parent out of this, that if you can find something to do with your kids, it spans over a long time. It seems like it can be rewarding.
Yeah. How about writing letters to their future selves or, you know, it's something that has to do with time and maturity. I think there's a lot of fun little projects you can do with your kids and in a long-term, longitudinal way that it'll be interesting perhaps to them at some future moment. You know?
Yeah.
Who knows?
All right. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate it.
Good talking to you guys. All right.
So each week we take a call and question from a listener, and we would love to hear from you. Please give us a call at 424-255-7833. That's 424-255-RUDE. Ask us anything, and we will do our best to answer. That being said, today we are not going to take a call. Instead, our awesome colleague Mark Stern, who writes for Slate's LGBTQ blog Outward, is joining us to read a letter he got from a reader and to help us answer it. Mark, hi. Take it away.
Hello. All right. So this is a letter I got last Friday. Mr. Stern, I am a divorced father of three great kids. My oldest daughter is turning 7. She recently brought a book home from the library about a penguin family, the same book that you wrote about in today's Slate. While reading it with her, it became clear very quickly that this was about a gay penguin couple and a child. We live in a suburb of Cincinnati, and the environment here is pretty conservative. Although her mother and I have never and would never shy away from LGBTQ subjects, her real-life exposure to anything LGBTQ has been non-existent. While both her mother and I have gay and lesbian friends, the subject of their sexuality has never come up around my daughter. In reading the book, she asked for an explanation for why both penguins were boys. I explained that sometimes boy penguins loved other boy penguins and girl penguins loved other girl penguins, and that this is true for us people, too. My daughter then asked to clarify for herself, so that means that they can love each other and get married and then they can adopt kids? I was stumped on how to answer this. It's still illegal in Ohio for lesbians and gays to marry, though hopefully this will change soon. Without trying to explain the political and sociological background to this injustice in human rights, I simply said yes to her question. But now I'm questioning this response. I want my kids to be aware of the injustice and oppression in our society and to act on that injustice as they are moved to do. But my daughter's 7. I want to explain this to her in a way that she can understand, but also not confuse her or the message I'm sending. I've asked my friends, and they're stumped on this as well. I know you aren't in the advice column business, but I've always enjoyed your articles. I can skip over this part.
No. What else did you say?
You're so handsome.
And your writing style and your hairstyle. And so would you have any ideas on how to relate this to my daughter? Thanks for taking the time. So that's the question.
It's a great question. So we want to have you talk a little bit about what you think, but I would first say what I have in fact said to my kids on this specific issue. I live in a state, Virginia, where gay marriage is not yet legal. Right? That's one of the states where it's not legal. Right.
Although a judge has ruled that it's invalid, but the ruling was stayed and it's being appealed, so it's still not legal.
Mark has encyclopedic knowledge of every state and what Friday they're going to declare gay marriage legal on.
It's really a curse.
This question has come up in our house, and I answered it in a way slightly different than this letter writer did, which is to say that I said, yes, gay people can get married. They can adopt children. Some states, including our state, have laws that suggest that maybe they can't. But in every state I can think of, those laws are well on their way toward being overturned. I think those laws are unfair. A lot of people think those laws are unfair. And so it won't be long before those laws don't exist anymore. And sometimes laws don't keep up with the times. This is a case where that happened. And I feel like Lyra basically got that. Like, she understood it. I didn't have that same conversation with Harper. I'm not sure exactly what it would have been, but I did try to make clear that this is a case where the law as it exists is not right and not fair. And luckily, it's one of the unfair laws that is actually going to get overturned really soon. Like, that's in the cards. It would be harder, I think, maybe to talk about laws that you as a parent consider unfair, but that aren't in any danger of being overturned anytime soon.
So I think that's a great tack, especially if you have very sophisticated children and your dad writes for a magazine and your mom is a constitutional law lawyer.
Sure, yeah, that helps.
I think that for the rest of us, for other parents, that's one way of approaching it. If your kid is maybe 9 or 10 or 11, then that's probably the best way, although, I mean, at that point, they've probably read about it on Twitter. If your kid is 7 and you know, she doesn't have a really firm grasp of, like, you know, how laws and the courts work, I would suggest maybe taking a slightly more dumbed down approach, honestly, and say something like, you know, for a long time, people didn't understand that it's okay for two men or two women to love each other and have children. But nowadays, most people do understand that. And so, you know, even though for a while people were confused about this, it was a big controversial topic, nowadays it isn't so much. And in a lot of states, two men and two women can get married and have children and love each other just like anyone else. And it'll soon be like that all over the country. Really simple. And if your kid doesn't get it at that point, then maybe that's when you introduce them to that gay couple you know. And right. And then they talk it out.
Right.
I love that answer. I mean, I like both of those answers, but I really love that answer. And I think basically all of our answers are similar in that we don't think you should completely ignore it. That, well, I understand kind of, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, I think, that the inclination of parents sometimes to gloss over injustice in order to not introduce an idea in their kid's head that gay people are different or that, you know, this person of this race is different. That's something that we should actually not do because people are different and it's fine for our kids to have that, you know, to know that.
One thing that I could have added, I think would be useful to people is, I mean, there's a real parallel in civil rights struggles, right? You can use that, I think, as an example, because almost every kid I know by first grade, because of Martin Luther King Day, has had a big conversation in school about the civil rights movement, about the fact that people used to think that black people shouldn't be allowed to do things that white people were allowed to do. But obviously we know that that's not true and everything changed. And I think that that's a useful parallel to if the part of the description is, well, people used to think that two men and two women shouldn't be allowed to love each other for some reason, but that has changed now. And that's a parallel that you can make as well.
I think that's completely right. And, I mean, don't tell the Christian right that you're doing that because they'll be all over you. But I think for the rest of us, the Martin Luther King comparison works perfectly. Kids know who he is. Kids understand that the civil rights struggle happened. I think by age 6 or 7, it's talked about in schools. And so why not just draw that analogy? It's not perfect, but it doesn't need to be perfect for this situation.
Right. All right. Thank you, Mark, for coming in. And sharing that question with us. And thank you, letter writer, for writing in. And remember, we would love to hear from you. So once again, momanddad@slate.com or give us a call and we'll answer your letter on the air, 424-255-RUDE. All right. Let's move on to our second segment. Before you're a parent, you're someone who's thinking about becoming a parent. Rebecca Onion, who edits Slate's history blog, The Vault, is such a person right now. But she's worried that along with parenting will come marital discord, conflict and resentment over who's really doing the work in the home. So in an essay in Slate, she wrote about her desire to create a pre-pregnancy contract with her husband. As she writes, wouldn't a not at all legally binding document outlining expectations and setting a course for periodic re-examination of the division of labor alleviate my fears and prevent aggravation or fights or divorce in the future? Rebecca is joining us on the phone to talk about her piece, to talk about what goes into the decision of whether to be a parent or not, and about what such a pre-pregnancy contract might actually say. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
So first of all, congratulations on thinking about maybe possibly considering having kids. That's a big step. So the tell us a little bit about what led you to consider such a, I think for many people would consider this sort of a radical act of bureaucracy.
Since my sort of immediate friends and family have started having kids in the past 5 years, and I'm 36, as I said in the piece, I've been thinking about it more and more, and I've sort of come to believe that while I've been thinking a lot about the labor of it, and I've been talking to my mom friends a lot about the labor of it, I don't think that my husband necessarily has the same kinds of conversations with his dad friends, sort of the parallel men of those couples that we're friends with. And indeed, he has admitted to me that he doesn't necessarily have those talks about the way that sort of the day-to-day of life changes once you have a kid.
Yeah, we're mostly just talking about our balls.
Actually, after I wrote the piece, I went on a Toronto radio show, and the host asked me if my husband was having conversations about sports instead of that. And I was like, no, not really.
Yeah.
That's not his way. But for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to be in the forefront of his mind. And so I started thinking about this as a way to codify the kinds of conversations that I wanted to have with him about those eventualities. That is where I started thinking about it. And then when I started doing more research into it, I found that the 70s feminists, as with many things, had talked about it before. And so I started looking at it more closely.
Do you view such a contract like this as something that is meant to cover every exigency, or is it something that's meant to cover just, say, the first few months of parenthood, or is it meant to be broad or specific? Like, have you thought necessarily about the nuts and bolts of what such a document might entail?
Well, I think in some ways the 70s feminist that I was referring to earlier, Alex Shulman, she had a contract with her husband that was both macro and micro. So she had sort of macro principles that they would agree upon, which had to do with the equal worth of each of their work. Even if their work wasn't paying the same monetarily, she wanted her work to be considered to be the same, her time to be considered to be just as valuable as his. So that's not a day-to-day thing. And then she had a list of micro day-to-day things, you know, splitting up who was going to do the dishes on what day, who was going to be the one to take the kids to school. So they already had kids when they made that contract.
Right.
So that makes it totally different, and that makes it so that they sort of knew what their family life, the quotidian sort of things that they had to do would be. And we obviously don't know that. So in some ways, I feel like the macro things are the things that might be the most effective in this kind of a situation. So for me, it would be things like wanting to have some assurance that I could have protected space to write. So as I mentioned in the piece, since I'm a writer, I feel like my time is so much more flexible that any emergency would probably be my business. So things like that, things like trying to agree on, you know, visits to in-laws and family, how things like that would work with a kid. More for me also, I was interested in trying to talk about setting time to re-examine how everyone was feeling about what labor was going on. So
That seemed like one of the most important aspects of what you were talking about. And one of the things I thought was most interesting in your piece was this notion that maybe the most important thing that can go into a contract like this is our provisions for renegotiation and provisions for discussion.
Yeah.
And as in fact, the contract itself becomes a means of ensuring that these things are always being discussed and never just sort of fall by the wayside.
This actually, your piece actually inspired me, Rebecca, because my husband and I have, you know, we fight about a lot of the stuff that I think, as you say, most of your friends tell you that they fight about with their spouses. And we actually started doing, well, we did it one Sunday. We did it last Sunday. We'll see if we do it this Sunday.
Yeah.
That we said every week we're going to sit down on Sunday night, open the mail, first of all, which is like this you know, pressure. It's just this constant thing weighing on us because we never open the mail. But then also talk about, oh my God, that really made Dan laugh. Also talk about
this vision of your house being covered in mail.
It is.
Oh, shit, the mail.
It is. But then also talk about the things coming up this week, whether like the little things, like who has to shuttle who where, and also like somebody needs to make the doctor's appointment and some, you know, the dentist appointment or whatever, and divide that stuff up. And one of the things that really resonated with me in your piece was that you talked about your fear of becoming Captain Mom, the captain of the family, and that your mom was that person. And I think often women are the default captains, which doesn't necessarily mean that the women always or the moms always do more, but the moms are somehow responsible for telling, for holding all the information of what needs to be done. So like my husband is more than happy to go pick up, you know, groceries on the way home from work or make the dentist appointment or whatever, but I'm still the one who knows when to tell him to do that. And I don't want that responsibility. So Dan, I'm curious, as the man in the room, do you feel that way? Do you feel like it is that your wife, that Alia, kind of,
is the captain of the family?
Is the captain of the family.
More than I wish was the case. I think that I am better, I think, than many partners in relationships who are not that kind of, who are not the captain necessarily, who are not naturally inclined to be the captain. I'm better at, like, you know, at going to the grocery store without anyone having to tell me I have to go to the grocery store, or making dinner without anyone having to call me and say, oh, don't forget to make dinner for our children. But stuff like doctor's appointments and crap like that off is like never at the forefront of my mind. And so my big step upon reading your piece, Rebecca, was that this morning I emailed Alia and was like, wait a minute, our kid's birthday is coming up. I bet she needs a doctor's appointment. So
now
I'm going to do that. I know.
Yeah.
But I do think that that's a pretty endemic situation. And it doesn't always necessarily fall along gender lines, but you're absolutely right that very often it is the woman becomes the captain of the family and the dad feels like he is doing his part by saying, oh, honey, I'll do whatever you tell me to do.
Related
to
that,
the honey-do list, which is like an odiferous thing.
But do you guys think,
go ahead, Allison.
No, I'm just curious if you guys think, I also hate this. And like I said, I don't want to be the captain, but I also wonder, does there have to be a captain? I think maybe there does. Like, I want this sort of ideal co-parenting world, but I'm not sure how that works, if it's possible.
I don't think there has to be a captain. I think that the goal, and, you know, I think this is sort of a broader goal, too, is that the goal of a document like this, and maybe of many marriages where there's maybe an initial disparity between the person whose natural inclination is to keep up with everything and the other person whose natural inclination is to keep up with nothing, the goal should be for both of them to move toward the mean a little bit, right? So that the person who is like very anal about making sure every doctor's appointment is made right on time and making sure the house is spotless recognizes that once children come, all those things have to get a little bit messier and a little more ad hoc. And the person who otherwise wouldn't think of those things has to get better about thinking of them more often so that they're pulling their weight.
I think that's one of the things that I was thinking about a lot while writing this was that there may be, between me and my husband and maybe between other couples as well, there's this like sort of like a spontaneity gap. He sort of prefers that things outside of work, I mean, within, this is the thing that kind of gets me, is that within his work life, you know, he's very organized and on top of things, but he doesn't like to necessarily have to think of home as a place where that also has to happen, where you have to, you know, maybe start keeping a Google Calendar or start keeping sort of having reminders or, you know, sort of quantifying your home life in a way.
Right.
Where he sort of sees that as draining the sort of emotion out of it. And some of the email responses that I got to this piece have said that to me as well. You know, like, you're making something that should be about joy into this, like...
That's crazy. No, that's not
that's
about joy.
Bullshit.
There are plenty of joyful things about having kids, but doing this crap is not joy.
It's, right.
Well, this is my argument, is that I feel like that is a lot of sort of work for the mom hides behind that in a way. You know, this feeling like, oh, but, you know, for example, within my family reunions, we love to just feel like, oh, we're just hanging out. But then, of course, like ever since I was about 13 years old and started being a feminist, I noticed that my aunts and my mom and my grandmother were doing all of the dishes. And I was like, oh, all of this spontaneous hanging out is sort of undergirded by this this thought, this sort of mom thought that's going on.
Right.
Spontaneity is made possible by work. And so making it clear who does that work does not kill spontaneity. It enables spontaneity.
That's
so, Allison, if... Oh, sorry. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, no, no. That's my same... I agree with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Plus one.
So, Allison, if you were going to... if you had been drawing up a contract like this before you had kids with John, knowing what you know now about stuff, is there one provision that you feel like would be a must-have in a document like this?
I think... Ugh, it's so hard because there are so many little things.
Right.
I think that I wish we both took responsibility or dealt equally with our childcare situation with, you know, I wish there was a way to sort of say, you know, when childcare falls through, we're both equally responsible for filling that gap. And also in terms of like the communication with our nanny, I think that is almost entirely on me. And I wish that that was not that way.
I think
so
that's
that
really
would be
good.
The main thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mine would be this is a provision that I wish that we had thought of, although we couldn't have known before, but I wish that we had thought of this before we had kids. But I wish that we had really actually written down and set out a specific set of requirements about the very first weeks of babyhood and maybe the first 3 months of babyhood, the time specifically when Alia was on maternity leave and I took some leave. But also I was working, but I wish that we had really delineated specific responsibilities for that time. And obviously this is not relevant to the entire rest of our lives as parents, but I wish we had said, you know, when will I take off work? How many days will it be? I wish we had set all this up beforehand instead of just being like, I guess I can take a week now. I wish that we had specifically said who gets up late at night. Who, if you're nursing, who gets up late? If we're bottle feeding, who gets up late? And then what does the other person do to make sure that the person who got up late then has time to like to nap and rest and like collect themselves? What are the specific things that the other person is going to do to help that person? Because for this happened to both of us when she was nursing and she would get up really late. I then did a shitty job of making sure that during the day she was like basically compensated for that. And then when we were bottle feeding and I got up late, then she did a shitty job of making sure I was compensated for that. And that we should have done better with that. Like laying out really specific rules for that would have been a big help.
Yeah.
All right, Rebecca, I hope whatever you guys decide to do, if you do decide to make a little adorable Rebecca Onion baby, maybe you'll check back in with us and let us know if the contract actually works.
Yeah,
yeah.
I definitely will.
We would love to hear. And we'd love to hear from listeners what you guys think about this, whether you know, drawing up a contract like this can work, and what are the provisions you'd want to have in yours.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to do this on the Parenting Podcast is we have a lot of parents who are listeners, and I think a lot of you have thoughts about what you would have included in your contract if you could have, if you had known then what you know now. So please, email us at momanddad@slate.com, and Rebecca will be hearing and listening to those emails carefully, as will we. Thanks.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks so much.
Okay, on to recommendations. So recently, listening to Slate's Double X Gabfest, there was a segment on summer beach reads, and somehow that segment turned into the three women, June, Noreen, and Jessica, recommending like reading difficult, challenging, really long books on the beach. I think the titles War and Peace came up, and The Power Broker, which the Power
That's
Broker is
incorrect.
Like what? Like, you know, thousands
incorrect.
Of pages. Right. It was a very slatey summer beach segment, very counterintuitive. But I just kept thinking, oh, you do not have kids, ladies. Because for me, a beach read, I cannot even manage really a book with a Cosmo and a pink stiletto on the cover. I like to read magazine pieces. So I'm just going to recommend a good magazine piece recently that just came out this week in Rolling Stone. It is by the terrific writer.
Oh, is it Vanessa Gregorogiadis' piece?
Yes, totally. Thank you for pronouncing her last name for me. About Jason Patrick's custody battle. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but Jason Patrick was a sperm donor for his ex-girlfriend, and now he is trying to get paternity rights to his child, and he's gone on this media crusade, and the mother in this case has not been much heard from, and she's now spoke to Vanessa for this piece, and it's very interesting. We haven't talked about this at all on our show, but Emily Bazelon has written about it for Slate before. Father's rights, paternity rights, it's a completely fascinating and difficult subject, and this piece is definitely worth a read. So it's called Tempest in a Test Tube in Rolling Stone.
That's a great recommendation. That's a really good piece. My recommendation is for an activity, a very specific activity that my older daughter just did this past week for the second time. I recommend this specific activity for anyone who wants to sign up for it, but I also am making this recommendation to colleges everywhere to please institute this program because it's like a mint. You can print money. My daughter went with her grandfather last weekend to Madison, Wisconsin, to the University of Wisconsin's campus for Grandparent University. Grandparent University is a two-day program in which a grandparent takes a grandchild to campus. The grandchild chooses a major. I made little air quotes with my hands when I said that. They stay in the dorms. They eat in the dining hall. They go to a day and a half's worth of activities that all revolve around this course of study. There are a bunch of different choices, photography and theater, but also many of them are science and tech based. And so Lyra ended up doing a two-day sort of mini course with her grandfather in biotechnology. So
that was her choice, biotechnology?
It was her third choice, but she did not get photography or theater. But she loved it. She loved it. And she – so like they shook cream to make butter, and they played with DNA models, and they did a whole project where they did experiments with, quote, alien blood, because there was a crime scene and one alien committed the crime, and they had to figure out which alien it was by using like a mass spectrometer or some shit on the alien blood, which I think was just marker, but whatever. She loved it so much. And it was a great bonding experience for her and my dad. It got her a little bit excited about science. It also just got her very excited about the concept of college in general and has really brought that into focus for her. She understands now why we talk about saving for college and why it's important and why she might like it. She loved the food because she got to eat a donut and a bagel and sugar cereal for breakfast at the dining hall. It was just great. And so
freshman 15.
Right.
Watch
she's
going
to get it in like one day. But yes. Grandparent University at the University of Wisconsin is great, specifically, but more broadly, every university alumni association should create exactly this kind of thing because it gets kids excited about these colleges. And for example, my wife's mom is already like, why does the University of North Carolina not have this exact program? Because I want to take my children to Chapel Hill, not stupid Madison. So come on, get on it, everyone.
That's really cool. I want to see if my university or where my parents went does the same thing. That's a great idea. Good recommendation. Okay. Thank you. Thanks to Chris Wave for producing this podcast and also to Andy Bowers, executive producer of all Slate podcasts. Thank you to our intern, Laura Smith. Thanks to all our guests. Thanks, David Plotz, for being a great editor all these years. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you all for listening.